Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to our fourth session. Now we are transitioning into some topics that relate to sociology, let's call it, or even politics. And what we're going to be doing is looking at some of the arguments that are made usually against Muslim people or Islam in general. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. Like, for example, you'll find that a lot of people, especially on the alt-right or the right wing or neoconservative contingents, they would say something like, if Islam is true, or if you have all the answers, and how comes, you know, your countries have X, Y, Z problems in them? Or how comes, there are not Nobel Peace Prize winners that are Muslims? In fact, interesting, I think Richard Dawkins made this argument. You know, how many Nobel Peace Prize winners are Muslim? So therefore, this shows you that the state of Islam or Islam is weak and doesn't give us any solutions, these kinds of things. So we'll be looking at that today. First of all, let's go with that. Let's get you guys involved from the beginning. If you were confronted with someone and says to you, look, if you're trying to sell us Islam, but if Islam was so good, why is it that we find that most of the economic potential of the Muslim countries is not on par with that which we find, for example, in the West? Why is it that we don't find that there's Nobel Peace Prize winners are Muslims, or Nobel winners that are Muslims, comparative to, say, for example, atheists, who are overrepresented in this thing? How would you answer these kinds of interrogations? Would you want a bit of time to think about it?
I mean, first of all, is that question is like an Orientalist question? What is a Nobel Prize? That's... Mm-hmm. Particular way of, it's just a science prize. I understand that, but you know what it's not, you know, reflective of everything. I don't see why it should be held to such a high degree.
Exactly. Yeah,
within our communities or something. Yeah, like we have other paradigms that we can use to gauge success and stuff like that.
So I think that's powerful. We say that gauging success, we're not just using barometers, if you like, of measurement. What else would you add, Mahdi, for example?
Like Tariq said, like, the Nobel Peace Prize is not a measure of success. So is an economic, to a certain extent, like, to be financially or materially wealthy doesn't necessarily mean you have success, in essence.
How so, then?
We would say, as Muslims, yeah, and if you, like, have that spiritual connection with God, you follow the way of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that is what is the measure of success.
And is it even fair to say that, comparative with non-Muslim countries, for example, Western countries, liberal countries, countries which adopt human rights, countries which adopt state liberalism, or secularism, whatever it may be, that those countries have a higher propensity to overperform economically comparative to Muslim ones?
It will depend on the metric that you're using to measure. So if some would use like happiness index, someone else might say real GDP, someone else might say GDP per capita.
Okay, well, let's use any of those. For example, let's use GDP per capita, GNI, the happy index, which is a combination of different, like HDI and life expectancy and all these kind of things. Okay, so even if we do that, what are we going to find?
Like you got countries like Japan, who are incredibly successful economically, but socially they're suffering. I mean, there's cases of people who they spend their lives not developing relationships with other people, and you know, they, like, you've got the rent-a-friend phenomenon in Japan. So all the economic success in the world, it can't literally buy you happiness in that sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got all other kinds of social problems, suicide and stuff like that within these countries.
Yeah.
So it doesn't...
And going back to this, so there's some really interesting points you're mentioning there. And I think it's important to note that when if happiness in the happy index comes up in a discussion, just because a country has a high score in terms of the happy index, it doesn't mean the inhabitants are happy, by the way. Because the happy index, I haven't got the exact way they measure it in the first place, but the happy index, it doesn't do a psychological study on how people actually feel. They don't go and ask people, how do you feel? And they look at things like the Human Development Index, the life expectancy, education, all these kind of things. And the assumption is, if those things are high, then people are more happy. Now, is this assumption fully justified, partially justified, not justified at all? What do you guys think?
I think there's also a thing here where they're assuming that happiness is the main purpose in life. That's what one should seek. But there's many things that you could say are better than happiness.
Okay,
there's like a saying like, a depressed Socrates is better than like a satisfied fool. So, you know, you could be like, you know, fulfilled in all your base desires. That doesn't necessarily mean, you might be happily in the terms of pleasure, but happiness as a whole, you might not be more happy. Or there could be things better than happiness, like contentment, stuff like that.
Beautiful.
So,
okay. I think there's lots of good things that people are saying. So let's take each one at a time. I think we need to go back to what you're saying here, because it's very important that this assumes that happiness is the ultimate purpose of life. That's an important point. But back to the point of economic development indicators, there are many indicators, as many of you have studied economics in the past or something like that would have known, or would know, which is like, for example, the GDP of a country is basically the gross domestic product, how much a country has inside of, how much money it has inside of. But they have things like GNI, which is the gross national index, and then the GDP per capita, how much on average each person gets. So it's like a mean. They get the average salary divided by the amount of people that, whatever, like, you know, in the country. And actually, it's a misconception to think that countries which have adopted or had been, or started as liberal countries and so on, are more likely, historically or contemporaneously, to have a higher economic output. And the reason why, you mentioned Japan. Japan actually is not, it's not a liberal country in the same way as the United States of America is. It's not secular in the same way as the United States of America is. It doesn't have the same culture as the United States of America. It doesn't have human rights the way the Americans have it, for example, or the French have it, or whatever. So Japan is a counterexample to this idea, if you think of it from that perspective. Another thing is, actually there are countries which have African countries and Latin American countries, okay, both Sub-Saharan Africa and Latin American countries, which are not Muslim majority, okay, especially in Latin America, there's no Muslim majority country there. You can even say there's no country with a Muslim, a significant Muslim output there, but which function on the same kind of level as from a GDP, GDP per capita, GNI, all that stuff, as Middle Eastern countries. So, for example, there's about 17 countries in Latin America. Maybe I'm wrong. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Of the 17 countries in Latin America, compare them with, X amount of countries in the Middle East or North Africa. You'll find there's a lot of similarities in terms of the economic output. Sometimes it underperforms. And in terms of crime, certain countries in Latin America are way above, Mexico being a serious example of that. You go to Morocco and then go to Mexico and tell me which one is safer, you know. So this is one thing. The other thing is that Latin America has adopted, to a large extent, liberal policies, secularist principles. A lot of them have. Not all the countries there, but a lot of the countries have that. They're not based on religion. I mean, it's not Islam there. Let me ask you this question. What is in common with Latin America and the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa? Or big parts of it?
They're very religious.
Okay, fine.
People.
So there is religion, but there's something I'm looking at here, because if we're trying to make cause-based arguments, there's something which is in common with all these three regions.
I would say they're not white enough.
Huh?
I would say they're not white enough.
They're not white enough. Yeah. Well, I mean,
I know, it seems like a
yeah. In the sense that the white man has taken a lot of the economic potential. But I think you're onto something. What is a key word beginning with C here?
Colonialism.
So what is in common between Latin America and the Middle East is both have just come out of colonialism. Now, I think this is not really taken, we don't consider the extent to which colonialism has actually had an impact on these regions. Because if you think about it, if you have a country in Sub-Saharan Africa, in North Africa, in the Middle East, Latin America, which has suffered 200 years of colonialism, 200 years, maybe 300 years, depending on which country we're looking at, yeah? Do you really expect it to come out, this newly independent, so-called independent country, and not be playing catch-up? Its resources were being extrapolated for two centuries, or more than that. There were people that their resources were being destroyed. Look at the case of Algeria, for example. It was annexed into another country. People were being raped and killed and all these kinds of things. The Spanish colonialism was one of the bloodiest things that have ever happened in history in Latin America. It's one of the bloodiest things that's ever happened. Now, you've got to tell me that these countries, after this colonial overstay, that they're just going to come out 50 years, 70 years, and then that's it. They're going to play complete catch-up. That's what's in common. I mean, you can easily make a stronger argument that which is in common in terms of causation, and it has a direct effect on people now, is colonialism, not religion.
I would argue they're still controlled by colonies, most of them. Maybe not directly, but indirectly.
Yeah, I look at, for example, the French influence on North Africa, and especially like Mali and these kinds of countries. Spain, I mean, there are some parts of Morocco which Spain still controls. I'm not sure if anyone knows this. Septa and other countries. What's the other one called? Yeah, these are cities, Spanish cities inside of Morocco. So you're driving around in your car, you literally go in, and these are the Spanish cities inside of Morocco. And if you look inside, they've got, in many cases, they've got better resources in there.
It's a huge difference.
It's a huge, have you been there before?
No, no.
Well, you've been told, yeah? I've heard that as well, I've never been there before myself, but I've heard it's a major difference. But this is what we're talking about, a major development here. But another thing is that there are countries which are Muslim countries. There's 196 countries in the world, okay? 196. Of them, about 59 are Muslim majority, which is a significant number. And of those countries, there are countries which are in the top 10 of GDP per capita, which are Muslim. Brunei is there, Qatar is there, Saudi Arabia is there, I think Kuwait is there. You'll say, well, that's because of the resources. Yeah, it is because of the resources, no doubt about it, no issues. That's part of the reason. But a lot of the reason why some other countries, like Iran and like Turkey, have maintained a strong economy and strong militaries and strong presence is because they haven't been colonized. It's no coincidence that Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Iran are three of the strongest Muslim countries in the Muslim world right now because they haven't been colonized. Iran wasn't colonized. Turkey wasn't colonized. And neither was Saudi Arabia. And look, they maintain a level of economic integrity, which the other Muslim countries don't have. There are other countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, which are doing very well. Pound for pound, they're doing very well. And they were colonized. So that is actually very impressive, considering the circumstances, what Malaysia's been able to do economically. Considering the circumstances, very, very impressive. So this idea that, if you put religion in or take it out, religion is a reason why. It's a foolish idea, especially considering there were times, so this is the contemporary argument, but there were times in human history where, for example, the Ottoman Empire was doing much better than the European rival. There were times in history where African Muslim countries, like the Mali Empire, was doing better than European rivals.
Europe started to become like a big thing just recently. Before that, it was Asia and Middle East.
And what events? I think we've covered this. Maybe we've covered this before. But what events have taken place in European history which have made that the case?
I think it would be the discovery of America.
Yeah.
Fall of.
That's a big one. So the Age of Discovery.
Yeah, and then after that. Even after that, it was mostly at that time Spain, Spanish colonization, and then all the gold and all the resources that they brought from the Americas, and they sent it all around Europe, and then Africa, when they colonized Africa and they colonized Asia, that's when really
Yeah, that's when they made a name for themselves, right? And that's a major difference between, especially if we're considering, I mentioned this point before, and I think it's worth mentioning again. This is a major difference between how Islam expanded and how, for example, the European countries expanded. Because some will watch and say, well, you're talking about colonialism, what about Islam? When Islam spread, especially in the early days, the resources, for example, that were in Egypt or in Yemen or wherever Islam spread to, stayed in those countries. They didn't go back to the Mecca. Whereas with European colonialism, the resources that were extracted went back to London or went back to wherever it was. That's a major difference, by the way. So the resources stayed in the land. People's houses were not taken away from them, let alone their person. Like in the case of transatlantic slave trade, they weren't forcibly moved around like that. If there was slavery, it usually stayed within its own borders. And if it didn't, it existed before. There wasn't an attempt to say, well, we're on a civilizing mission, we need to get these race of people to go there. So there are major differences between how Europeans expanded versus how Islam expanded in the early days, especially, yeah? Another thing I'll say is,
if you talk about nowadays, probably the biggest reason why these countries don't succeed is not because they don't want to succeed or they don't have the capabilities to succeed. It's because it's not in their interest, in Western interest, to let these countries succeed. Like Africa, when it was colonized and then after divided, it was divided in a certain way. So you have a group of different ethnicities divided into in different countries, which created conflicts. And even now, one can argue that they create conflicts, so countries stay in those wars, and they never get to grow. The best example is recently Pakistan, when there was this prime minister, and because he wanted, Libya, I think Gaddafi, he was one of the best examples when he wanted to create his own currency and wanted to create Africa to become something like Europe. Mm. And I think it was very obvious that was going totally against Western agenda. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And you mentioned a good point when you said, okay, so there's the age of discovery. There's three or four events which I think is very important for people to know. There's the Age of Discovery, which took place, let's say, 17th century, yeah? Like 1600s. In this country, it was Elizabeth the First, who kind of popularized the notion, and she sent off the different people to go and stuff like that. And then after that, then you had the Scientific Revolution. This is the second thing which many people must know about this time. And one of the main reasons why there was a scientific revolution was because they wanted for ballistic missiles and armory and guns and all these kind of things. In fact, behind you there are books. Yeah, you can see these books, and maybe you can get me one of them. One of them says natural philosophy or natural philosophy. Can you see one of those? You can see, yes, and it's in that section. One of them says, it's a whole book. It says natural philosophy. Yeah, I'll explain this to you if I get it. But science was called natural philosophy. It wasn't called science. Yeah, see there, maybe this little small book. It's called natural philosophy or something like that. You got it, yeah? Is that yeah? Look at that, very nice book. And then kill me if you see that I'm doing this. And then she's collection here. Don't worry, I'm handling it with great care. As you can see here, it says natural philosophy. Okay, this is a book. I would presume this book has probably been written somewhere in the 17th century, right? Let me open it up and see. This is well after. In fact, they were even calling it this. It's 1827. This might have been the third print or something. But nevertheless, if you open it up and you look at this natural philosophy, for example, it says here on the laws of motion, on the attraction of gravity, on optics. And then on springs and fountains, mnemonics, the structure of the eye, and so on. this is one book. It's meant to have all of the things inside of it. Back in the days, they used to call this in our tradition, Christians have this as well. They called it Summa. A Summa was a book which contained all the things inside of it. So it contained logic in there. It contained science in there. This is what it looks like. It contained science in there. It contained religion in there. So it was meant to be like almost encyclopedic. But in the scientific revolution, they started specializing and dividing. So science became its own subject matter. And so you had like physics and chemistry and all these things. Now this really took place in the UK again. It was, the reason why was engineering purposes. They wanted to engineer guns and all these kind of things. So you have first the age of discovery, then you have scientific revolution. And then you have the industrial revolution. And now we're going into the 19th century. Yeah. Now with the industrial revolution, that's when you have steam trains. I'm sure you guys have seen. And once again, this is in the UK. But the part of the reason why it was happened in the UK is because some of the natural resources that were required, like coal and stuff, only existed here in the UK. So these events that took place, the Age of Discovery, the scientific revolution, the Industrial Revolution, put the West in a very special position. Especially comparative to its rivals, the Ottoman Empire wasn't developing fastly enough, especially technologically and stuff. It was not developing as fast as the other rivals. That's why the Ottoman Empire used to have many wars with the Russians. And in the beginning, they were winning all these wars. And then afterwards, you see that they started losing the wars because they weren't keeping up technologically. So one of the biggest, especially the printing press, you know, we're going back to like 17th century or something, yeah? 16th, 17th century. With the printing press and technological developments, there was no catch-up. And then you had divide and conquer and, you know, tribalism and nationalism within the Muslims, which led to infighting, and then now we're in a specific space in history which the Western Hemisphere is in control. You know, Western Europe and its extensions. But if you consider, most Russians don't consider themselves as part of the West. And if you divide Russia from Western Europe and its extensions, and America, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because then we will say, when did the superpower reign of the United States of America begin? Somewhere in 1991, 31 years ago or something like this. Why? Because that was the end of the Cold War. And so that's what, before you had what we referred to in international relations as a bipolar system. I don't know how the Cold War from, was it 40 years or something? 40 something years. And in that time, you had two great powers fighting each other. Now, really, you have one great power and these other competitors that are vying for superpower status. So that's the history of how we got to where we are.
Even with those wars, you know, during the wars, you have the best. You come with the best inventions, with the best. You create the best things, like because of this First and Second World War. We had cars and planes and better cars and better planes and better and all kinds of technology.
And so that's why it's a good point. Technological developments really took they accelerated in wars, especially World War I and World War II, because necessity is the mother of all invention. Okay, so now we know what the world, how it got to where it is. And that was very simplistic, but the notion, therefore, that Islam, where Islam is, you know, you don't find as much economic, things going on. We can see how weak this is, because it's trying to put correlation and causation. It's trying to create a fake link between correlation and causation. That link doesn't actually exist, especially if we look at history. Yeah. All right. So, what we're going to be doing today is we're going to be looking at a book that was written by someone called Wa'il al-Hallaq. Now, this might take one or two sessions. The book is called The Impossible State. Okay. Well, Halak is not Muslim. I think he's a Christian. And this book became very, very, especially in academic circles, it became very important, in fact. I'll tell you something interesting. There was a guy called Abu Qatada. You know, the accused of terrorism with the huge beard. And I think this might be misattributed to him. Bawal Halaq said that the person who understood my book, really understood it, was Abu Qatada. I don't know what we want to make out of that, but it's interesting. Basically, one of the things that Bawal Halaq argues is that the Islamic State, judged by any standard definition of what a modern state represents, is both impossible and inherently self-contradictory. Now, why does he say that? I'm going to tell you why he says that. The argument he makes is that basically, the Sharia and the modern state, both of those two things together are contradictions in terms. He says that the modern state is taken for granted by leading intellectuals and Islamists, and by that he means people like the Muslim Brotherhood and those who want to engage the political process. The Muslim world is coloured by post-colonial realities, which we just explained. Yeah. So, let me explain some more. He says that, first of all, he speaks about the concept of the citizen. What is this idea of a citizen? So, nowadays, like, we're all British citizens. I hope, I mean, some of us, I should say. You know, others are still, you know, waiting for the papers or whatever, you know. But when we're in a state, a modern state, you get preferential. No one speaks of discrimination. If, this is a very interesting and basic point, but just think of it for a second. No one speaks of discrimination as it relates to citizenship. So, for example, I go to an airport and it says, like, you know, if you have a British passport, go on this line. Any other passport, go here. No one says this is an act of discrimination. Do you see the point? So if I have a British passport, come on this line. And me, I always have to go on the other line anyway. I'm joking. But, you know, if you have any other EU passport, whatever, go on the other line. Or if you're in Spain or in any other country, the whole thing is if you have to get a visa to go into the other country. No one says, well, why do we have to be treated like second-class people? There's only a discussion about second-class citizens. But the idea of citizenship is there already. No one says why do we have to be treated like second class citizens? Why is citizenship taken for granted? Because it is a form of discrimination. Just see the point. It's definitely a form. But the idea of citizenship is there, and he's clever for bringing this up. He's saying this idea never existed in the Islamic world in the way that these guys are making it out to be. We didn't have citizenship like that. We didn't have, like, okay, you're a Muslim citizen. What does that mean? You had Muslim subjects and you had non-Muslim subjects. That was historically what you had. If you are within the radius or the circumference or the area where the Muslim protection was taking place, then you had to follow the laws. But that's not because of citizenship purposes. Now, you know, if someone goes and does something in another country, there's treaties between countries that these are our citizens and this. So that's the first point of tension. He's saying citizenship. Any points on that? Any questions?
Do you think it should be that way?
Pardon?
Do you think it should be that way?
Like, no. Before we get to should and ought and all that stuff, let's lay out the framework that he's. The second thing he says is that he looks at Iran. Obviously, after 1979, the so-called Islamic Revolution, yeah? And he says it's disfigured. He calls it disfigured. He says because they're trying to put things together which don't belong together. So they've created a parliament, yeah? And then you've got the mullahs. And so you're putting two things which are not... what's the point of the parliament if the mullahs are going to make all the decisions anyway? So he calls this disfigured, and there's a good point here. If we think wisely and carefully, why do you have this parliament? And then you have elections. And in fact, he goes further, and I think he makes a very powerful point, which is almost impossible to argue against fully. You can say, well, I argued to some extent or whatever. But he says the very fact that you have a democratic system, think about it. Where does the sovereignty lie? With the people, because democracy is Abraham Lincoln's representations for the people, by the people, and whatever, yeah? Of the people. of the people. Okay, but every 4 years. So that means that it's conceivable that someone, we the people, will decide we don't want Sharia anymore. So we put Sharia when we want it and we leave it when we don't want it. So he says, what kind of sovereignty is this? Where is the Sharia, where is the sovereignty actually lying? Is it with Allah or with the people? He's saying that actually when you have systems of democracy every 4 years or whatever it may be, where you can vote in people and take people out, then here, what kind of sovereignty for Sharia is this, if you can remove it? So he's saying this is the disfigured typology that he's referring to. That's why he calls it disfigured. So you don't even know where the sovereignty lies. You're trying to put things together which don't belong together. And he's also, not just Iran, but he's talking about the Muslim Brotherhood as well. And I think he makes a good point about that. Because, yeah, Al-Qaradawi just died recently, for example, rahimahullah. But one thing that Al-Qaradawi mentions, very candidly, right, is, you know, democracy is good, basically. Like, you know, democracy is part of the religion. But what are we talking about here? Are we talking about the democracy which means that a human being can decide that God's law is not implemented? Are we talking about the representative democracy which means that you can remove God's law and that we are the sovereigns over God's law? And I don't think there's much justification that can be made on that grounds, to be honest with you. And I think Wa al-Halaq's criticism is actually very powerful to this kind of thing, to the Muslim Brotherhood and to Iran's regime and all of them. That they have not been able to solve this, really. Any questions on that?
Yeah. Without going into the Muslim Brotherhood position,
yeah,
because I feel like there's some nuance there, but in a sense, it's relevant to what we were talking about before with this issue of economic systems. That, and there's one academic, Charles Tilly, I think, makes this point really well, that the whole nation-state system where you have, at least on a conceptual level, and to be fair, practically as well, a separation between religious authorities and political authorities and these different polities with hard borders that have sovereignty in and of themselves. It's something which was initially European.
Yeah.
And you could say that there were historical circumstances that led to the sort of organic development of that in Europe specifically.
Yeah. Well,
where you take that system now and the history that goes with it and the organic development of that in Europe, and then in the 20th century, that system gets kind of superimposed on the rest of the world.
Yeah.
That's where you end up with the tensions that you have now, because
sort
of overnight now, like, you go from Islam and that the moral ethics of Islam having a place in the law and Islam being crucial to people, how they identify with their political establishments or institutions, whatever. And then all of a sudden, now there's a nation state and this body is sovereign and it's recognized by, that's entrenched by the UN, all these different things.
Mm.
So that's where that tension comes from.
Yeah.
And so I think...
And that's exactly... By the way, we just said that's exactly what he says.
Yeah. So that's sort of his argument. That's what he points out. And so I think that's the challenge, basically, for, frankly, any Muslim political project now operating within that dynamic. Because as long as you're within the nation-state system,
you're
always going to be wrestling with that tension.
Exactly. And that's exactly what he's saying. You're going to have to endure those contradictions. There are issues there. And to pretend that actually democracy is fully compatible in all of its every single way with the idea of a sovereign law that's from God, that's problematic. And it's not something which anyone can definitely easily argue, you know. So anyway, we'll move on to another thing which he says, which is that, so as you mentioned, that to put it in a word, he says that the modern state's genealogy is exclusively European, okay? And so he also says that morals divorce from science, economics, knowledge, etc. Whereas in Islam, there's no such divorce. So in other words, morality and all the other workings of the economy are divorced. Whereas in Islam, everything is together, you know? So the question really is, what is subordinate to what? Is the law subordinate to the ruler, or the ruler subordinate to the law? In Islam, everything is subordinate to the laws of God. Simple as that. and that was ijma, consensus. But then when you have democracy in the modern state and all these kind of things, the opposite is true, at least in election time or when the referendum is being done. Is democracy subordinate to Sharia or the Sharia subordinate to the will of the people? So this is the question, yeah? You got a question? Oh, okay. So this is Halaq's basic criticism of Islamism, yeah? That Islamists are trying to create a modern state when the apparatus are both are basically incompatible with one another. The Islamic apparatus is incompatible with the modern state and vice versa. So let me read out to you what Halaq says, and then we can discuss in groups and come back and see how to what extent you agree or disagree, yeah? Halaq states, this is in his book, so I've just taken some pertinent, you know, things that he said. He says, first, as an anthropocentric entity, the state possesses a metaphysic that resides within its own boundaries as sovereign will. As the highest manifestation of positivism, the state possesses and displays a metaphysic of the here and now, reflecting its own concepts, structures, and practices. What is for the state is its truth of will, its will to power, all other truths being marginal and subordinate. By stark contrast, no form of Islamic governance can permit positivism, nor is there a place for a metaphysic that issues therefrom. If the autonomy of the moral is the highest of all, how do you say this word? Desiderata. Yeah? Then metaphysics which foregrounds moral autonomy cannot descend to positivism. Second, and flowing from the former consideration, Islamic governance cannot permit any sovereignty or sovereign will other than that of God. Islamic governance is thus bound by a sovereign will outside of and higher than itself, whereas the modern state's sovereignty represents an inner dialectic of self-constitution. Sovereignty constitutes the state and is constituted by it. These two opposed conceptions of sovereignty will inevitably stand in a deadlock. Third, and flowing from the former two considerations, if God is the only sovereign, which is to say, if God is the ultimate source of moral authority, then any system that regulates human behavior must heed the general norms and technical rules and regulations derived from and dictated by the higher moral principles. Fourth, and reflecting the aggregate effects of the former three considerations, the modern state produces subjects that differ from those produced by any form of Islamic governance in profoundly political, social, moral, epistemic, and psychological ways. The microcosmic insistence of the Muslim subject on the unity of the is and ought is a faithful representation of the microcosmic sharia, maybe, and Sufist insistence that fact and value are one and the same, that all existence is a unity, and that the term poor is in Quranic discourse and in the Muslim social and economic life is not a statistic or a scientific datum. Fifth and finally, the modern state, in its collaboration and contestation with the globalization project, remains engaged in a preeminently material world of fact. It depends on and promotes a homo economicus, whose exclusive and ultimate, what's this word again? Desideratum, is material profit and little else. This stands in sharp contrast with the morally constructed homo economicus of Islam and its governance, a species that is subordinated to a higher moral imperative. This latter subject is neither contingent nor mere accident in the structure and makeup of Islam and Islamic governance. It is of its essence. Let's take, this is a lot to be taken. So what we're going to do, work in groups of two and have 5 minutes just to take this all in, summarize it, and then tell us we'll have a discussion, tell each other what we think. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's get some quick summaries. What do you think he was trying to say in the thing that we just read out?
The first point, you know, to put it very crudely, he's basically saying that in normal West, you know, the West, or you know, what we could call Western governments or whatever they are, they place high emphasis on pragmatism, like he said, the highest manifestation of positivism. And whereas as a Muslim, with Muslim governments, we have a metaphysic where we believe in things like heaven and religious things as which are incompatible with modern
positivistic
positivistic
notions. Yeah, I think that is one of his points. What else does he say? So let's quickly summarize everything else. Yeah. So what are we had 5 points altogether, didn't we? You guys.
So you want a summary of each individual point?
Yeah, why not?
So the second point he makes is basically that, whereas you could say the nation state system requires that a certain body, be that a parliament, a government, a sovereign, whatever, is absolutely sovereign within that boundary territory. Islam doesn't really permit that, because Islam puts that sovereignty in God, that Allah is the only one that has that ranked or that station to be able to legislate absolutely and for to be obeyed. In al-hukmu illa lillah, amara Allah alla ta'budu illa iyyah, that guide, that the right of judgment, but like that Allah is the only one who adjudicates and judges law in an absolute sense.
In this country, for example, parliament is sovereign. Yeah. They call it parliamentary sovereignty. And so such notions in an Islamic state would be completely not acceptable. You know, so he's saying that because that sovereignty, it comes from God. So, I mean, the whole idea of a parliament, if you think about the infrastructure of a parliament, right? A parliament, one of its main functionalities is to create law. That's what a parliament does. I mean, if, for example, let's go back to this country. You have the House of Commons, and then you have the House of Lords, which now they're calling the Supreme, I don't know, whatever. It used to be called the House of Lords. Now it's called the Supreme Court, I think, yeah? In the judicial sense. Because the House of Lords was actually the highest judicial body, as well as being a secondary, second house. Huh? In the 2000s, yeah?
So it came out from the households, became an independent thing.
The Supreme Court. Yeah. So there's always these checks and balances in place, but the idea of the House of Commons is you've got this process where you have a white paper, and then it goes, usually initiated by the cabinet, the government, the executive, call it whatever you like, but can be, technically, though hasn't happened, I don't know when was the last time it did happen, one of the backbench MPs comes and puts forward an idea for white paper and law, and then it actually becomes law. Because the law process is actually a very long one. You have to have the presentation of the white paper, and then the first draft and the second draft, and then debate, and then they argue over it. And in America, they have very strict laws on what passes as law, and certain percentage of the House, whether it's the House of Representatives or the Senate, and there are two, just like in this country, in America, there's a House of Representatives and then there's a Senate. Their job is to pass through laws. In America, it's a little bit more complicated because you have a codified constitution with amendments in there. And if you want to add an amendment, there has to be, once again, there's numbers. Like, for example, if you wanted to add an amendment, you have to have, I think, 2/3 of the backing of the House. From memory, it could be 3/4 of the 3/4 of the House and
of the states
of the House of Representatives.
No, 3/4 of like the actual individual states in America.
In the Senate.
No, so it's I think it's first
two-thirds
of the
House of Representatives.
Yeah, and the Congress. So that they have to, like, 2/3 of them have to go for it.
Yeah, and then three quarters of the states.
Yeah, from the
Senate then.
No, like from the states of America.
Yeah, well then they're represented through the Senate, right? So
like I think their individual legislatures, they each have to 3/4 of.
Yeah, that would be through. I think that would be through, because the thing is, from what I remember, each state has 2 senators, right?
Well, that's different.
Yeah, each state has 2 senators, right? Anyway, we've gone back into 10 years or 15 years ago, yeah. But politics, A-level, whatever, yeah? but I think each state has 2 senators, and the House of Representatives is done by proportion of population of a particular state.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you have a state with a huge population, like the state of New York or California, then they have more members in there. Anyway, there's a certain threshold that must be met in order for a law to pass or an amendment to be made on the codified constitution. The idea of, you can't have separation of powers if you don't have power in the first place. And the idea of a legislature in any government is that they make laws. That is the job of the legislature. They make laws. That is the job of the legislature. There are 3 primary parts of any government. There is the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. And in modern states, there has to be a separation of powers between all 3 of them. So you can't have, for example, there are checks and balances. They call them checks and balances. That's why in America you have the Supreme Court. Yeah. Now these Supreme Court, is it 12 or 9? I can't remember. However many there are there, I think it's 9, because it has to be an odd number in it to get. Otherwise, they're going to keep getting, you know. There can't be, it would be a problem if they were also making the laws. Do you see what I'm saying? Imagine if they were, you're a senator and a judge. That would be impossible. That's not allowed, actually. But the idea of a legislature is that you're meant to create laws. Now, in Islam, the laws are already there. So how are you going to create laws? The laws are in the Quran, Sunnah. So there's no need for creation. So it renders the legislature as a redundant body. We don't need the legislature. The laws are there. The one who created the heavens and the earth and the atoms and everything in quarks and strings and whatever you like, that one who created everything, we trust him with all that. We also trust him with the laws of God. With the laws of the world, yani how we should govern ourselves, how should we get married, how should we eat meat, how should we go to war, all of that is there. There are some things which the Sharia has not spoken about directly, like traffic laws and stuff like that. There you can have a discussion. You know, how would that be passed? It would be passed by the ruler, by the Khalifa, by the Sultan, by whomever. But and it's important to note here that traditionally, especially in books of yani imama, whatever you want to call it, where how is an imam chosen? An imam is chosen in Islam through al-hali wal-aqd. It's chosen by the elites. Like, for example, Al-Juwayni mentions this in Al-Ghiyathi, and Al-Mawaridi mentions this in Ahkam al-Sultaniyah. So you have these people who are the elites, meaning what do we mean by the elites? The scholars, the ones who are most influential in a particular society, the economists, whoever it may be. Like if these people were removed from society, then there'd be real problems. These guys will come together and say, this is our new leaders. So in a sense, you know, in America, they have something called the Electoral College. They still do have it. But they used to refer to it as smoke-filled rooms. Like people in smoke-filled rooms, they choose the leader and all that stuff. Because they would choose the leader who would be, a leader of a particular political party, or they would count the electoral college votes or whatever it is. For us, it's that. There would be people that are the elites that would choose who the next leader is. That's it. That's how it's done. Now, this leader would then get legitimacy through doing bay'ah or asking for bay'ah. This would give him legitimacy and a mandate. which means he's asked now for a pledge of allegiance from the people. If he's unable to garner yani pledge of allegiance, it doesn't mean he cannot be in charge, but it just means he's going to find it real problematic. Really problematic. And that's why traditionally this is, you need to get some level of legitimacy. And that person, in order for him to be, or I'm going to say, or her, even though the majority of scholars, they don't accept a female leader. All of them don't accept as a khalifa. Yani, there's 9 conditions of being a khalifa. One of them is actually you have to be Qurashi. I'm not sure if you have to be from Quraysh. Doesn't mean that you have to be Arab, because there's many people that claim to be from Quraysh from all different types of background. Yeah, there's 9 conditions. You're Quraysh. You have to have some lineage back to Quraysh. And one of them is Dukura, which is that you have to be a male. Okay. Now, what if, like the Ottomans, they're not Qurashi? What do we call that? You call it whatever you want to call it. Call them sultans. It's just for a label. It's, for all intents and purposes, the same thing is not going to be... It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what you call them, sultan or khalifa. If a woman... This is controversial. In the books of fiqh, and like I've just mentioned, like these kind of books, they say, what about ghalaba or taghallub? What if they stage a revolt like the Abbasids did over the Umayyads and they become in power? So Al-Mawaridi, he mentions in his book that this is ghir shara'i. It's haram to do that. He mentioned it. That's not right to do that. But he says if they do and they succeed, then you have to follow them. He actually mentioned so a lot of, you cannot offer your, you cannot be a ruler without power. It's called shoka. Shoka means you have to have power to protect the people. This is why, especially like ISIS and these Daesh and these radical groups, terrorist groups, and what's the other one called, Jabha, and all these ones, they could never be. They can never be the khalifa of the people, because they cannot offer me. How can you offer me protection? You cannot offer me protection. One of the prerequisites is that you have to be able to offer me protection. You have to, if I'm going to give bay'ah to you, if I'm going to give allegiance to you, then you have to be able to protect me, my honor, and myself. But if I'm here, if you live anywhere else, if I'm in Egypt or I'm in Lebanon, or you have no power to offer me, you can't protect me. Well, I'm going to give you my taxes now, and you're not even giving me protection. The Prophet Muhammad ﷺ even made a contract with the Jews that he protect them in return for the jizya. So they pay jizya, they get protection. So I'm some bab awla. If that's a Jewish, he's being protected under the Islamic State. So you want me to give you taxes and give you allegiance and pledge, and you can't even protect me? So, yani, that's just one technical point of why a caliphate can actually never be actually declared without shoka, without this idea of being able to give protection. But the reason why I've given you this kind of insight is because, just to let you know, that there's a difference between the democratic representative democracy system and what Islam says. And no matter what the scholars of today who are inclined towards whatever way of thinking say, classically, the way of choosing a leader in Islam is different, has been different to a representative democracy. There are similarities, clearly. Similarity, number one, bay'ah. There's a people process of legitimacy and mandate giving through the people. And by the way, this was men and women. We gave bay'ah. So now they're celebrating the fact that women has a vote for 100 years. Women were given bay'ah to the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ from 1,400 years. That's the truth. Yeah, so that, yani, that's one. Number two, there's a shura process, Ahl-Hali wal-Aqd, which is consultation process. So we believe in shura, which is consultation. We believe in bay'ah, which is pledge of allegiance. And there are some traits within those mechanisms which resemble representative democracy, but they're not the same. And if we lie to the people and say, yeah, we believe in democracy, aslan, like, we're not using it as a lesser of two evils. We believe in that. I'm not saying whether it's allowed or not allowed to be used. I'm saying whether we're saying it's part of our religion. That's a real problem here. Because if it was part of our religion, why wasn't it documented 1,000 years ago? This is a real problem. Number three, you have to have protection. So as we said, the ghalaba thing. Now we're saying, a Mawaridi and a Juwaini and everyone says, this is ghir shara, you're not allowed to do this. But if it happens, then yes. And you know, these Madkhali types and secular Muslims, other ones, they'll say, they have a big deal about not obeying the ruler. The truth is, this was the majority opinion. But the way they take it further is on a different kind of level. You know, they make a mockery of themselves in so doing. But the idea of obeying a ruler, a Muslim ruler, that rules by Allah's books, a book and stuff, this was there. The issue is, who does this apply on, who does this not apply on? What if it's a Jew that's in charge of Muslims, but the Muslims don't have the power to fight him? And then the issue of Qudra and Istata'a comes into place. If they don't have the means to get rid of him, what do you do? You create bloodshed, you know? These are big things that are way above my pay grade, but it's important for you guys to know about it. So, sorry, the reason why I brought this up is because, just to show you, there's a difference in that system and that, in the system of Islam. Classically, at least, there is a difference. What was the third point? Did we mention one or two points just now?
Two.
Two, okay, what's the third point?
that the consequence of establishing what was established previously, that really and truly Islam will find it difficult to accommodate a sovereign other than God, that the system that regulates human behavior must heed the general norms and technical rules and regulations derived from and dictated by the higher moral principles. So it's in a sense a reiteration of the previous point, that morality is absolutely defined by God. And I think it's sort of related to that. I'm not sure if this ends up becoming point four. Actually, it does. He sort of intimates towards that where, I guess, in a lot of nation state arrangements, there is a theoretical and practical division between that which you might legislate as law and that which you might consider to be moral. So you hear people today, for example, I'm against abortion morally, but legally I'm a libertarian, so I don't think the government should get involved, for example, yeah, without saying anything too stringent on the abortion issue, but it's just an example. That distinction between those two things is not really something that Islam permits. So law should be in line with morality, not apart from it.
This kind of division recently in certain du'at and making that distinction on national TV and stuff. And even, like, this is an academic here who's not Muslim, who's saying, I don't agree with this, you know, which is quite embarrassing for us. And what's the fourth point?
Yeah, so that was sort of the fourth point, that so in a sense that fact and value are the same. He makes reference here to the Sufi idea of that all existence is a unity, but the idea is that there is no separate sphere here operating on one side, the facts and the figures and what is, and then on another side your moral considerations, which have largely been relativized and privatized in the nation state system, that those two things are sort of interlocking, one and the same.
Okay, what's the fifth point? Someone finish it off for us? Would you want to finish it off? Just and then we can do a quick discussion.
Yeah, reiterating the point of this thing about the positivism and the facts, that worldview also has implications on how you look at human beings. So whereas there, he's saying that the modern world is looking at the human being as the quote-unquote the economic human, you know, the rational actor and all of the things that come along with that, Islam is viewing the human being in a different way.
Mm. Okay, so let's open this up, guys. What do you think the strengths or weaknesses of what he's saying is? Well, how do you evaluate what he said? Do you think what are the strongest points he makes? Do you think, Furkan? What do you think?
I think first, I think ultimately we have the law that needs to be followed is God's law, and he's right in the sense of that if we let the people decide, then we wouldn't be following God's law. And I also think we would have a better society in the sense of we wouldn't have so many of these new problems that we find nowadays with feminism and all this.
Mm. It's a good point. Mahdi, what do you think?
Fundamentally, democracy or like the law of man to legislate, to have that will or that power is incompatible with Islam, because in al-hukmu illa lillah, like God is the only one, Allah is the only one that can legislate. So to have like a democratic state is not really compatible with Islam. And
so what do you think the Muslim Brotherhood and the Nahda and these organizations, what arguments do you reckon that they would counteract what you're saying with? What do you think they would say?
I'm guessing they would agree with some parts of democracy, that the parts that are incompatible, they say you should implement, or whatever's not. Yeah.
First, I'd say that are these direct quotations from what?
Yeah.
So, I think to be fair to him, that his position regarding to sovereignty is that Allah remains an ultimate authority. Mm-hmm. So. You sort of made the point as well that it doesn't necessarily mean that, for example, it becomes haram for someone who's in charge to, you know, do traffic laws or, you know, some education laws or whatever it is, some of these things where the Sharia has not really taken any firm position. Like the Khalifa will have to operate within the general spirit of Islam, or even whoever the leader is has to operate within the general spirit of Islam to legislate in line with the interests of the religion. But then with the democracy point, the discussion would be, or I guess the nuance would be, is a person saying that democracy is, you could say, the ideal system, or that is what Islam came with
in its entirety. That's what Yusuf Qardawi was saying.
In its entirety. Perhaps, I guess, it's how you understand what he's saying. Like, if someone says that, given the situation that we're in and the restraints that we have to operate within, this is a pragmatic, like if someone proposes a democracy, I have to rewind a bit here. Mm-hmm. So democracy for nobody is a perfect thing. Yeah, no, I haven't come across anybody who's ever argued that. I think anybody who ever argued for it on pragmatic grounds. Yeah,
mm. Or instrumental.
We need this as a way to like peacefully depose leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why they put all these checks and balances, you mentioned, constitutions in place to mm-hmm. basically, you know, allay the worst effects of a polity gone wrong. Yeah. So if now some Muslim groups will say, like, given the situation that we're in and the constraints that we have to operate within, if we have a system where you have a democracy that focuses on the election of leaders, for example, that operates within firm constraints that are put down by the Sharia for the time being, I guess that's the argument they would make and say, look, this is what we're trying to do for the time being.
Is that the argument progressing they towards. Have made?
What is that? Wallahu a'lam. That's how you take it. No, there's different aqwal and things like that.
No, I think with that, it's, you would find that even being said amongst Salafis, like Ibn Uthaymeen with this, you know, hardcore, but very, very well-known Salafi person of the last 34 years, he's saying in order to, he was asked a fatwa question, should we vote in the American elections? He said in order to choose the lesser of two evils, yes. But he made it clear that what he was saying was, it's the lesser of two evils, that's why we're doing it. Whereas in Qaradawi, in contradiction to this, is saying no, he's saying that democracy, we want a state of democracy. This is which of the two would you think is more right here? For example, sorry to say, and then you have a third opinion. Should we put this in there? Should we make it even worse? Then you have this opinion of some groups who say that even engaging in this process takes you is a kufr, is shirk. It's something which is disbelief, just engaging in this. Is that a tenable...
Does anyone's definition of democracy here mean, like, democracy as it's known around the world? Because if it is that, and you're saying man can legislate, I mean, as a Muslim, how can you advocate for that?
It's incongruous. Once again, like
if you're going to maqasid and things, well, this is the intention and that, but you're just like putting layers upon layers upon what you're trying to say. Like, when it comes down to it, what is democracy? How does everyone understand this definition?
Yeah, go ahead. I see your point. Good point. Go on.
Yeah, I think this may sound extreme, but I don't think that there can be a democracy which is fair. I think people, most people are not able to decide what's better for them.
This is Plato, what he said, you know.
So probably the best, if you had to choose a democracy, I think it would have to be very, very limited, only to those people that are capable to decide or are aware of issues. So
it's a test. So you have to pass an exam to actually, vote.
Actually, I had an idea like that. Yeah, I would choose the first one, if the lesser of the two evils. Like,
Yeah, okay.
Just.
So you acknowledge that it's not ideal.
Yeah.
But you'd say that, okay, we're just using... Because there's three opinions, if you want to say them, in the Muslim world right now. One opinion one, which seems to be zahir of the qawl of Qaradawi and stuff, the apparent saying, the Muslim Brotherhood seem to be saying this. Democracy is part of Islam and that's what we want. Qawl two, or the second opinion, is that it's a lesser of two evils and we use it instrumentally. Qawl three is that actually it's kufr and shirk, and if you do it, you've committed disbelief, which is the view of some brothers from Hizb al-Tahrir, and also the view of the Takfiri groups. Although having said that, Alwan, who's big scholar, that you know some radical groups used to ask him for fatwa, he said that he believes his kufr. Yeah. He said he believes it's kufr, however, if you do it, you're not kafir. Now, there are some things that which are kufr, but if you do, you're not kafir. Yeah. So I'm just giving you all the kafir meaning disbeliever, Yan.
Yeah, but I think with respect to those who hold the third opinion, and maybe with... Anyways, yeah. That third opinion, I think, is based on a misunderstanding of what we're talking about. Because I think they hear our democracy, our laws, and then they are... understanding from that this means that you are getting rid of the authority of the Sharia in that equation, and you are doing like tafdil of some kind of man-made
law. How
would
you refute
the divine
third opinion?
Over the divine law. So you say, look, if you, I guess the one that we like has been used is the one with the example of Yusuf alayhi salam. If what you're saying is that to operate within a governmental structure that isn't necessarily fully compliant with the Sharia, it becomes kufr because you're legislating with other than what Allah has legislated with. Then you have Yusuf alayhi salam, who's working in the who's a minister in
how do we know that the minister was not Muslim?
What's that, man?
كان ليأخذه في دين الملك. He wasn't going to take him into the religion of the Malik. إلا أن يشاء الله. So clearly, he was not Muslim. He was not Muslim. The king at that time, and he was working with him. In fact, Joseph in the Quran makes a case. جعلنا على خزائن الأرض. You know, he says, "Make me, preside over the treasures of the earth," meaning the today's treasurer or something. Yeah. So that's why Ibn Taymiyyah said, if someone is going into this. If someone's going into a situation and it's bad, but he wants to make it better, then this is يَدْخُلُ فِي قَوْلِهِ فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ مَا اسْتَطَعْتُمْ. That, you know, and have fear of Allah as much as you can. The third opinion, therefore, seems to be quite weak. But so does the first opinion. To me, anyway. I don't know what you think. The first opinion, which is that democracy is part of the religion of Islam. Yani, Islam and democracy are two sides of the same coin. Representative democracy, maybe it's I don't agree with that either. I think the second opinion here,
in the first opinion, what do you mean by democracy? Or what's intended by this? Because there's like I feel like there's so many conflations here. We have on one side democracy as a legislating thing. We have another
democracy, so where you can choose a leader, and there is a potential that the leader is not Muslim even, or that he doesn't represent Islamic ethics or laws, and there is a potential that there are some that will implement some laws, and there's a potential that some will not implement all the laws. Or that in the American example, if it was American elections or British elections, Jeremy Corbyn or something, yeah, he doesn't implement Islamic laws, but he's more favourable to Muslims, you see. So the argument is that, well, we're not voting for him because we agree with him. We're voting for him because we're trying to lesser an evil, or because it will make life easier for Muslim people.
So the Ahwanis that you're referring to, are they saying that?
Who?
The Ahwanis that you're referring to, yeah. Are you saying that they're saying that we're going to use that democracy, meaning a representative democratic system,
mm-hmm.
where we are electing people that are going to legislate by other than what Allah has revealed?
No, that, it's that not that we're electing. It's a potential that they can be elected.
And they say that's compatible, right, with Islam?
Yeah, that's what Khardawi is saying.
But look, in theory, once again, devil's advocate here. But in theory, if you do bay'ah and you put in and now the Khalifa is Hajjaj or some other like Zalim in Islamic history, there's potential that anyone who's given that power can. So if it's based on potential, then you have the same thing with the bay'ah.
Yeah, but bay'ah is, even if the bay'ah is not concluded, the person can still rule if they have shoka.
Yeah, but if through that, it's possible to have a khalifa who's a zalim and legislates by other than what Allah has.
He's known as a Muslim. He's saying he's a Muslim.
The issue is an issue, let's go back to halak, is an issue of sovereignty. I haven't decided of like any zalim. I don't want anyone to. But the issue of takfir is dangerous because the question would be, to what extent? For example, we've got a person in the house, yeah? And this is where Kharijism and Takfirism can actually come. You can see it's a slippery slope, yeah? So, for example, you've got a father. He's the head of the house in Islam, yeah? He's a man, and he's a father, he's a husband, everything. And he puts on MTV music. Or let's say he puts on, puts on MTV music as a music video of a woman, you know, dancing and this and that on the screen. That's haram bil ijma. Would you agree with that? No, there is no call. It's ijma. Even Ibn Hazm will tell you. You know, this whole seeing a woman before, like naked before you get married and stuff, that's if you want to get married to them. You know, you have no chance of getting married, and there's no issue, no thing there. So what I'm saying is that, say for example, like the man, he actually puts it on. Or he allows his children or his wife or whatever to put that stuff on. Let's just say he does. What is the status of this man? Is he a kafir? Is he a fasiq?
Some of the Muslim marriages now, none of them pray.
No, but let's just stick with this example. Let's just stick with this example. And is that man a disbeliever? Because
no.
This goes back to a question of al-hukm bi ghayri ma anzal Allah. The question of what if you rule by what other than Allah has revealed. So then intention has a big part of it. If you're ruling because of shahwa. Yeah.
How's he ruling there though?
Because he's in charge. He can change the situation. He is in charge. He can change. He can rip up all the wires and he's in charge. Just as much as the Khalifa will be in charge. And we talk about these in Muslim lands, the concerts and stuff happening. But in a house, this happens. The same person who's criticizing, you know, the concerts happening in the house has got the concerts up on his television.
That's not really.
Do you make a distinction between a father who, for example,
like, no, but he's the head of the household,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So a father who allows his family to get involved in whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can say that's one thing. And then another thing is a father who puts on the MTV, but then doesn't allow his son to pray in the house, for example. Or like when his son is trying to do talab al-ilm, he says, you're not allowed to do that, you're not allowed to do that, he takes this away.
No, but now we're convoluting the thing. The talab al-ilm is not wajib anyway.
Okay, well, but anything that's part of it, let's say prayer. Right? If he stops his son from praying in the house,
okay,
does he become a kafir?
That's more complicated, bro.
Let's say his daughter go outside with makeup and he's okay with this. Is he ruling here? He just said the youth is happy with it.
Is,
right?
It wouldn't make him a dayuth.
If he's happy with it.
Dayuth is someone who's yaqbal fahisha fi ahli. He doesn't mind his wife or something actually having intercourse with other men.
So
That's what the tarif of the youth is. People use it freely for another one. But the youth is, they've translated into kak. Yeah. So it's a kak is somebody. Yaqbal fahisha fi ahli.
What if he's like, he has like friends that are all male and he's okay with this?
He's not the youth.
Okay.
He's lacking in moral ghira or all that stuff, but he's not the youth.
In Persian, it's pimp.
He's
Dayus.
Oh, is that what they call it?
Dayus, yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
That's the really, yeah?
Yeah.
PIMP, I don't know what you heard about me. But what I was going to say was, the point is that really this person who's doing this, who's letting his, let's say this example, because I don't convolute it too much, letting them watch whatever series or whatever it may be, he's not a kafir. Because he's got shahwa. He's desirous of certain things in this dunya. And because if you say that, then you're going to, there's such a fine line between saying that and saying, khalas, then any kabira that you do, is can you see? The khariji idea that if you do any major sin, that you're a disbeliever. Why? Because they actually premised it on the same idea, that you're doing hukum bi ghayri ma anzalallah. That's what they claimed. They claimed that they're doing hukum bi ghayri ma anzalallah. So if you allow yourself or other people to do this stuff, then you're doing hukum bi ghayri ma anzalallah, which is your kafir. So the question is, on what grounds is hukum bi ghayri ma anzalallah kufr akbar shu sahibam min al-millah? Is when the person makes it clear that they're doing it because they believe in that. They have to show us somehow that they believe in that. They actually believe that this law is better than this law. So if someone says, I believe that the law of putting people in prison is better than the amputation law in the Quran, this is kufr. I'm not saying the person becomes automatically a kafir, but it can be. Like if you do iqamat al-hujjah and stuff, because what are you talking about? The Quran has spoken on the matter. السارق والسارقة فقطعوا أيديهما جزاء بما كسبا نكالا من الله. So if Allah has spoken about it, then you're saying something opposite to Allah. So how you actually believe in what Allah says then? That means I don't believe that you believe. I have reason to believe that you don't believe. But if the person has ta'wil, for example, says that we can't put it in now because people are not ready for it, or we whatever, that's different. That's different, because at the end of it, he doesn't theoretically, he believes that the law of Allah should be in place. But this idea of believing the law of Allah is the highest is extremely important. There's so many ayats in the Quran about it. فَلَا وَرَبِّكَ لَيُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرَ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجِدُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجًا مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيُسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا. That by Allah they don't actually believe. Only Allah has done this few times in the Quran. فلا فبربك لا يؤمنون. By Allah, by your Rabb, حتى يحكي, until they make you a judge of what they have disputed among. ثم لا يجدوا حرجا مما قضيت في أنفسهم مما قضيت ويسلموا تسليما. They don't find anything like constraint in their hearts. يعني, and then they completely submit to Allah. This is the true belief of Islam, akhi. This is, if you don't believe in this, this is so emphatic. This is so emphatic. أَفَ حُكْمُ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ يَبْغُونَ. Do they prefer the hukum of jahiliyyah? Allah says that. Do they, it's a rhetorical question. Do you prefer the ruling of jahili, yani ignorant times, pre-Islamic ignorant times? Do you prefer man-made laws? It's a rhetorical question. وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنْزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنْزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الظَّالِمُونَ. And then other one, فَاسِقُونَ. Three times. Whoever does not rule by what Allah has revealed, then they're disbelievers. Meaning what? Not if the man is doing it from shahwa, or because he's being forced, or because the Americans are going to put sanctions, they're going to kill his people if he doesn't do it. None of that. It's because he prefers X laws over Y laws. He prefers it. He believes in it. That's the best way to spot a munafiq today. Wallahi, it's one of the best ways to spot a munafiq, a hypocrite, somebody who does not believe in Islam. He's a fake. When you start speaking to them and then you realize that they don't actually believe in this stuff, basically. Put it in a nutshell. You don't believe in this stuff, so you're a kafir. Yeah, the same God that created the cosmos and all this, you believe in, he created all that stuff. And he organized that, but he couldn't organize your life and my life. No way. Yeah. So these are three approaches. I think I personally lean to the approach number two, which is that we use democracy instrumentally, and it's definitely not kufr or shirk. I'm completely convinced it's not that stuff. And it should be, in fact, it should be used instrumentally if it would put us in a better position. But this idea that it's part of the religion and you get thawab by doing it and all these kinds of things, or yani it's ibadah, this is also haram. I think this is, to say that is taking it too far. Yani. I don't see how someone can come to that. I've been trying my best to understand it, but I don't believe in that at all. So I think the middle ground is best. Any questions on this or any points?
Well, if you have a country where marriage exists already, but a country where you don't choose the leader, but you choose certain people that didn't choose the leader, and the condition being that those people have to be Muslims.
That's exactly this, what happens here.
Where?
In the UK, for example, we choose the Conservatives, and then they look who they chose, Liz Truss. No one voted for this woman. She's the weakest leader in human history, actually.
Yeah, so we...
I forget about British history and human history. Do you know, I was watching the news. We'll end with this, sorry. I was watching my mum, yeah? And she came up and she was speaking and we'd been asked questions and stuff. And do you know what my mum said? She said, she's the Prime Minister. She goes, Akhir Hadi primary school teacher, yani. She's like, the maximum she could be is a primary school teacher. You know, is it, what the hell, like? I promise she's trying to take control of her country. She wouldn't be able to take control of a year 9 classroom. I promise you she wouldn't. She'd be in and everyone would tell her to get the hell out. And she'd have to call the deputy head and the male head teacher. Someone with a bit of force or something like that. Yeah, I said. But that, you know, I mean, it's absolutely... Now we have a system nowadays where the parties choose their own leaders, isn't it? And it's possible for... Maybe they should change that. Thing is, democracy is always sacrificed, okay? Because in this country, we have first-past-the-post system anyway. If they wanted the most democratic thing, they should have put together something called proportional representation, PR, which is what they have, ironically, in Israel, so-called Israel, yeah, which is Palestine, which is they have something called the list system, which is PR system. That's why they have to create a huge coalition of, every time they have... you know, they have to create a huge coalition of different parties. So, first past the post gives you disproportionate number of seats to the amount of thing. So they realize that you have to sacrifice democracy to get stability. They realize that, and they're happy to do it. And there's not really much debate. There was a referendum that I think, I don't know when this was, Nick Clegg, we wanted AV system, which is some happy medium between the first past the post system and the proportional representation system. And there was a referendum and it failed. I don't know what came up 10 years ago. Do you remember when this was?
It was when they did the vote. Cameron did it.
Yeah,
during
yeah.
his leadership to leave the EU. They had this, and they did that option, and then they did the option for
AV.
AV, yeah.
But most people in Britain decided no, because actually we want stability. We don't want democracy as much. So, khalas, let's take this thought to its logical conclusion. Do you know what I mean? If you want to sacrifice democracy, then sacrifice it properly and you get proper stability. I'm not advocating authoritarianism or dictatorship, so but I'm saying there's always a trade-off being made. But you are. Oh, I like it. So I've already got one of those at home. And on that bombshell, hopefully you have enjoyed this as much as I have. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.